The greatest drummers in the world in the palm of your hand. From the heart of Berlin, the Drum Trainer Online Podcast.
Hallo meine lieben Drum Trainer Online Podcast. Hier spricht Dirk Erchinger und in diesem Podcast stellen wir euch ein Interview mit dem großartigen Nate Smith vor. Der ist ja vor allem bekannt geworden vor ein paar Jahren durch die Drum-Videos, die Jose James von ihm immer live gemacht hat. So kurze, geile, brutale Groove-Soli. Dabei wurde bloß vergessen, dass der schon Jahre vorher unterwegs war mit Betty Carter und Dave Holland, auf zigtausend Jazz-Festivals gespielt hat, auch im Fernsehen war, aber da hat sich irgendwie nie jemand so richtig für ihn interessiert. Und nachdem Jose James mit diesen kleinen Videos angefangen hat, ist er so zu so einem totalen Star geworden und dann ja auch mit Wolfpack jetzt aufgenommen und so. Ein total geiler Typ, ganz netter Kerl. Wir hatten auch so sehr unkompliziert kommuniziert. Der war dann aus Versehen noch zur falschen Adresse gegangen. Der war zur Drumtrainer-Schule gegangen, statt zum Drumtrainer, und kam dann aber ganz lustig rübergelaufen. Selber Google kennt man für einen Ami gar nicht. Die sind oft so unselbstständig und maulen gleich rum, wenn sie mal zu Fuß gehen müssen. Der gar nicht. Ein super Typ, ultra netter Kerl. Wahnsinns-Drummer, also für mich einer der geilen Typen, die hier gerade rumlaufen, ist einfach extrem funky. Er spielt geile Licks und geile Rudiment-Geschichten, aber es groovt halt einfach die ganze Zeit wie die Hölle. Und er hat auch richtig was zu erzählen, das ist interessant, auch die Herangehensweise von dem, weil das hätte ich gar nicht so erwartet. In dem Fall. Wie sagt man? Also auf alle Fälle. Viel Spaß beim Interview mit dem großartigen Nate Smith. Bis später. Nate Smith at the Drum Trainer Online Studio. So great to have you, Nate.
Thank you, man. Thank you, Dirk.
Thank you for coming and sharing your ideas with us. Just very brief question: where are you from? Where were you born? Where you grew up?
I grew up in Virginia, which is in the southern part of the U.S. And I grew up in the southeastern part of the state, a city called Chesapeake. That's where I'm from. And I went to high school there, and I went to college in Virginia too, in a different part of the state at a school called James Madison University.
All right. So, the way you grew up, is, do you have any musicians in the family?
Or? No, I'm the only musician, man. I'm the only guy. I'm the first professional musician. We had my brother played drums in band. My sister was in band too. My mom sang in the choir, and my dad sang a little bit. And he loved music. He collected records. But I'm the first one to really make a go of it in my family, and so I was kind of blazing a trail for the rest of my folks.
So in your childhood, what kind of music would you listen to? What was the influence then?
A lot of the stuff that was playing in the house. My dad loved the music of the late 70s, early 80s, especially like the sort of hybrid jazz stuff. So he was listening to Quincy Jones and Crusaders and Grover Washington, Bob James, all that stuff. And so I was listening to that music, and I was listening to those drummers who were playing on those records. So all that stuff kind of seeped in at an early age. And my parents used to have parties, and they'd invite people over, and they'd play these records.
Right.
So not only was I listening to the music and absorbing it, I was also checking out how people react to the music, too. And they would dance and have a good time, you know.
Right. So when you were like a teenager, or I mean in the States it's more difficult, but would you go out to clubs and parties? You a dancer?
No. I'm not the dancer. If I did go out to the dance, I would be the guy who was kind of on the wall listening to what the DJ was playing and watching how people were reacting to it, you know. But I was never the guy in the middle of the dance floor.
But that's interesting, because I was wondering, the way you play drums today, I see it sounds very much like a hybrid between this 70s Harvey Mason beats and also like break beats from DJs today.
Absolutely, so. Absolutely. It's all in there. I didn't start playing until I was about 11 or 12 years old. So I'm kind of a late bloomer in that way. And I didn't grow up playing in church either. I started playing in church when I was a teenager, you know. The church I went to when I was a kid was kind of a quiet church. So we didn't have drums every Sunday. But we did, you know, on special occasions, we'd bring the drums out for like the special concerts, what have you. And my first gigs were at church, but I wasn't, you know, sort of enmeshed in the church music scene. Right. But yeah, a lot of the stuff that I checked out as a kid, from the hip hop I was into, A Tribe Called Quest and Public Enemy and all that stuff, to the rock I was into, Living Color, I was way into them when they first came out. And along with the jazz that I was discovering at the time, it all kinds of, you know, formed the base of kind of how I approached the drums.
Right, because that's what I read, that one of your big influences is Art Blakey.
Art Blakey.
So I know why. I think I know why, but let us know why.
Yeah, well, the first record I heard was this record called Album of the Year. It came out, I think, in the early 80s, 81 or 82. And my dad had, actually, it might have been even been later, like 85 or 86, but my dad had a copy of that record, and I checked it out. It was my first time really hearing Art Blakey, and I didn't know much about him. I didn't know, but all I remember hearing was that unmistakable press roll,
right,
and his riot cymbal and his attack. And this was later in Art's life when, you know, his hearing had started to fail, and
right,
he was, you know, so it wasn't quite the same. The strength of the groove was still there, but it wasn't quite as tight as his previous ensembles. But it definitely sent me sort of down the rabbit hole to find out more about him. So it was that record. And then there was another record that came out. It was a soundtrack to a documentary about Thelonious Monk called Straight No Chaser. And I remember watching that the video, listening to that music, and thinking, man, you know, I just love the way it felt. I love the way the drums sounded, you know, and I just loved everything about that record. So I just wanted to find out as much as I could.
Right. Yeah. And he used to play very brutal. That's what I always liked, what, like a big backbeat.
Art Blakey?
Big hit.
Yeah,
hitter.
Yeah. He was. And he was always grooving. The thing I loved about Blakey was that he, you know, the groove was always very important to him.
Right.
And I think that's part of the reason why he reached so many people. He had so many fans. He had so many great musicians who played with him.
Right.
Because they wanted to play with that, you know, unrelenting pulse that he would play with, you know.
So the first time you really played jazz, was that on college then? Or?
No, I was starting to play a little bit in high school. I was listening to records and starting to sort of play along. There was a high school jazz band I played in. But the first time I was really exposed to it was later in college. Yeah, I started to play in the school ensembles, and I started to really dig into the music library.
Yeah.
And that's when I discovered, you know, the rabbit hole got deeper, and I discovered Tony with Miles, and I discovered Elvin with Coltrane, and I discovered Jimmy Cobb with Miles too. Actually, the 58 Sessions, that band, that's really the record that's much more influential for me. Jimmy Cobb playing that unmistakable quarter note on the ride cymbal. I just love the music that grooved really hard. Yeah.
So did you really sit down and transcribe like note for note?
No.
Stuff like that?
I learned everything by ear.
Right.
You know, I you know, because I grew up in marching band, I can read music, and I do transcribe occasionally, but most of the stuff that I learned playing the drums was by ear.
Because that was my next question. So you played in marching bands, mm-hmm, so you had weekly training with rudimentary guys, so this is something we don't have over here, really.
Mm-hmm.
But apart from that, you did not have a teacher for a long time?
Or? No, I was mostly self-taught.
That's great.
I had a couple of periods of instruction when I was in college and as a part of the curriculum when I was a music major. And then when I did grad school, I got a chance to work with a really great percussion instructor, a guy named Howard Curtis, who actually lives in Austria now. He teaches in Graz over there. But I got a chance to study with Howard. And Howard was really the first regular teacher I ever had. And most of the time I spent with Howard, we would listen to records.
Right.
And he would just put on records and say, man, you need to check this out. You need to check out Victor Lewis on this record. Or you need to check out Dennis Chambers on this record. He would just point me in all these different directions. So he was my first real teacher. But up until that point, I hadn't had a regular private instructor. Yeah.
But would you think like it's important to have like some kind of a mentor like that teacher? Was it important for you in your career?
It was very important. I think, you know, mentors for me came in different forms. When I was in college, I got a chance to, the third summer between my school years, I got a chance to work at Disney World. And a lot of the guys in that band were from all over the country, and I got to meet them and talk to them about their hometowns and talk to them about, and I got to play with some really great guest artists. So I learned a lot in that. So in a lot of ways, I was mentored kind of by my peers in that situation, right. You know. And then the following year, I got a chance to work with the great jazz singer Betty Carter,
right.
As a part of her Jazz Ahead program. And Betty was the first famous musician or musician of renown to say, I hear something in your playing that I think is special and, you know, you should pursue it. That meant a lot.
Right. Yeah. That's what I read. You played with Betty Carter, mm-hmm. then later you played with Dave Holland,
yeah.
Ravi Coltrane.
Yeah.
So a lot of heavy jazz guys. So
yeah.
I was checking some footage, like
yeah.
back in the days, you
yeah.
were like a very great
yeah.
jazz player.
Yeah.
But what I think is interesting nowadays to me, if it sounds to me, so I'm checking a lot of that stuff from
mm-hmm.
Jose James.
Yeah.
So it seems to be like the change that you turned way more into a groove
pocket yeah.
player than
yeah.
than back in the days. How
yeah.
did that come apart?
You know, it really depends on what the music calls for.
Right.
In Jose's situation, the music calls for that.
Right.
It calls for kind of digging into an R&B vocabulary and settling into parts, playing parts, and really, you know, developing a vamp and playing it with conviction and playing it like you believe it, so that the audience gets into it too. I think that, you know, with Jose's shows, the audience is a lot different. The audience is kind of coming for a shared experience, you know, which is not to say that jazz audiences don't, but I feel like it's a different thing. I feel like,
yeah.
you know, they kind of want to dance a little bit and they kind of want to party, whereas a jazz audience is much more of a listening audience
right.
and kind of a studying audience. So I found that, you know, playing that has been really good, not only to for what the music calls for, but also in terms of sharing the music with the audience. I think it definitely helped.
Yeah, one more question. I've read that you also a composer. So
yeah.
you compose like production music for Discovery Channel,
yeah.
for movies.
I used to do a lot more of it. I haven't done so much of it recently, but I've been focusing most of my composing energy on my own band,
right.
my own project. So I just put a record out called Kinfolk. It came out in February. And we're going to start touring it this fall. And that's really the most, I think, cohesive statement that I've put out to date as a composer, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I'm very proud of it. I'm you know, it's starting to get a lot more notice, hopefully. So
so you'll be on tour with that project?
Yeah.
In
we start in, we're going to do some dates in the States. And then we're going to come to Europe in October. And I'll be putting all that stuff up on my socials. And, yeah.
Great. So, and I also read you worked for Michael Jackson back in the day.
I did, sort of by accident.
Right.
It was like I used to do a lot more R&B production. I still do it, but not as much as I did.
Right.
And I used to write a lot of songs, and I would, you know, pitch songs to different people. And to make a long story very short, it was through a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy. That this track that I wrote ended up becoming a song called Heaven Can Wait, which ended up on Michael Jackson's Invincible album.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not get a chance to meet Michael. I wish I did. It all kind of happened in my absence. But when the record came out, I got credit as a co-writer and credit as a co-producer. So it was, it's definitely something that happened.
So talk about Michael and those great records,
yeah.
Off the Wall and Thriller. So how did that influence it?
Oh,
how
man.
Can that not influence anyone?
Man, I those records are great. I really love the way, you know, John Robinson and Ndugu
yeah.
and all those guys who played on those records. You know, I really love the way they played, especially Off the Wall. It's kind of my favorite Michael Jackson
yeah.
album. And I kind of feel like it's his most R&B album.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about, you know, John Robinson on that record is just his touch. You know, you hear all that little stuff, all the little details and the hi-hat, the way he's playing it, the way he's playing the snare. I just feel like there's so much air in it.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful record. I just, you know, that's a record that I can listen to, you know, again and again and again and still feel like I discover something about it, especially the way the musicians are playing.
Right now we're talking to the management of John Robinson. Get him into the studio in September.
Oh, man.
So keep your fingers crossed
that it's
working.
I'll watch that episode for sure.
So right now you're on tour with Jose James.
That's right.
How many more dates?
We're only going to be out for 3 more dates. We've got tomorrow night at Lido here in Berlin, and then we've got Amsterdam on Thursday and Madrid on Friday. And I think we go home after that.
All right.
Yeah.
So... Two more things. We were talking about church. So are you a spiritual person? You consider drumming a spiritual thing also?
I actually do consider music a spiritual thing. I feel like we, as musicians, are able to, I think, maybe tap into a dimension that people who don't play music might not have as much access to, I think. And I think that we are able to share an experience differently with an audience than artists of other disciplines. I do believe music is kind of the most transparent art form. So we really do share a lot of ourselves with the audience, which is not to say other artists don't, but I feel that we really do, especially when you listen to great musicians who really kind of were seeking a spiritual connection through the music, you know, especially when you listen to Train and the records he made with the Legendary Quartet and how much he was searching for. I think we have a unique gift as musicians, and it's something that we have to protect, you know.
Right.
So yeah, I guess I do think that's a spiritual thing. Yeah.
Right. And last question. I mean, we are a school. Advice for young guys who want to make it?
Oh man. Oh, that's a good question.
It's a long question.
It's a long question, but I can boil it down to three things, I think. Be a cool person, be patient, and always do your homework. You know, study as much as you can, learn as much as you can about this music. Talk to as many people as you can, not only musicians who are, you know, famous or well known, but also musicians who are lesser known, guys who but who still play in a way that you admire. And just be curious. Be curious about the music, you know, always be curious about it, and always be absorbing and observing as much as you can.
Great. So thank you so much. Was great to have you.
Thank you, Dirk.
Hope we have a great intensive training today. Yeah. How do you like our style? Just for you, I brought this down again, this lamp, because I saw so many videos. It looked so stylish on all your videos.
Let me tell you something, man.
It's from the 70s.
Oh, this is great, man. this is actually, I really dig the whole thing. I noticed that when I walked in, man. I love the colors. I love this really warm.
Because I saw some of your videos where you had some very nice styling.
Yeah,
Do you wear suits and stuff?
Yeah, listen, I'm trying to bring a little class to the, you know, kind of class up the joint a little bit, you know. I think about the great, you know, Roy Haynes, and how stylish he was. And I think there is a way for drummers to be stylish and have that sort of swagger. So, yeah, man, I love it. I love what you're doing. You guys are doing it.
All right. Thank you, man.
Hey, thank you, man. Appreciate it.
So Leute, wenn euch das gefallen hat, dann gebt uns doch bitte mal ein Like und noch viel wichtiger, abonniert den Podcast, damit ihr ja nichts verpasst. Und wenn ihr diese ganzen geilen Trommelschweine mal in Action sehen wollt, besucht auf jeden Fall unsere Webseite drumtrainer.online. Da findet ihr über 600 Videotutorials mit über 60 Dozenten. Und da sind wir ziemlich stolz drauf und das kann sich sehen lassen. Also schaut mal vorbei, wir sehen uns oder hören uns. Liebe Grüße aus Berlin.